Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, where each week we visit with World War II veterans, hoping to honor them for their service and their sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so they're not forgotten, and along the way, be certainly entertained, kept awake, educated, and inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. We've got quite the story in store today with 89-year-old Jim Kitchen of Fresno, California. He's going to be 90 in October, and hopefully in October he'll be heading to Washington, D.C. with Central Valley Honor Flight. You've heard a lot about that. You'll hear some more. But we're going to go back a little further in time, not to the future, but way back in the past. And you grew up, Jim, in Oklahoma. What was that like before the Dust Bowl?
Well, to me, it was, I don't remember suffering any at all, because my brother and I, we just had a slingshot around our neck. We went hunting, and we just enjoyed what we were doing. We don't remember any hard times.
What would you hunt with your slingshot?
We hunted, but we never caught anything. Oh, we'd shoot at the birds, but we'd take our dogs and go down in the woods hunting, and maybe they'd jump a rabbit or something, but we just out having a good time.
And we're going to hear about what you did in World War II and about your more recent history with the ship you served on in the U.S. Coast Guard. But something really life-changing happened when you were just 10 years old. You lost your father at that young age?
Yes, I lost my father, and it was very disturbing because we were on a farm, and my mother couldn't do any farming, and I wasn't old enough to do anything. But anyway, my grandfather brought us out to California, and we stayed 3 months. We were in Antioch, and she was working in the asparagus on the river. And I had a sister that got quick pneumonia, and she died in 3 days. And we went back to Oklahoma and moved into town, and she was working in a plant where they canned meat. And my brother and I would do a laundry or washing before we went to school, and she'd iron it, and we'd deliver it in our wagons. She got remarried, and we came out to California in 36, settled in Orange Cove. And we were Okies, as we are called, and we're not ashamed of it, because we have enjoyed our lives very much.
You know, I could tell the first time I talked to you on the phone, and certainly meeting you here in person, you're someone who has a lot of energy, a lot of exuberance and enthusiasm, and I don't know that you would expect that to result from the kind of tragedy you dealt with as a young boy. What do you think it was that helped you overcome losing your father and your sister when you were just a kid?
Well, I can't tell you just what it is, but I guess I've just enjoyed living and just kept going.
So you come out to California in 1936 and settle in Orange Cove on the east side of the San Joaquin Valley. What was life like in Orange Cove in the late 30s, early 40s?
We enjoyed it because we were going to school, and I graduated there in 39 from the 8th grade, and I only know of one of them that's left yet.
Where'd you go to high school?
I went to Roosevelt, but I didn't finish high school. My mother, in 39, she got TB, and county came and says, "You're going to Fresno to the hospital." She had TB, sawed off 6 ribs, collapsed 1 lung, and sent her up to Wichita Sanitarium to die. But my mother did what the doctor said, told her to do. She came home 2 weeks before we went. My brother and I went in the service. We went in together. We were in boot camp together. And she got well. When we came home, she was working. She had got well and working at the community hospital in the kitchen, cooking. The dietitian took a liking to her and made her assistant dietitian. She stayed with her until she was retired, and she died at 86.
Wow. Well, I see where you get some of your good genes and that spunk you still have at age 89. Before I ask you about getting into the service, tell me about December 7th, 1941. What do you remember about that day? How'd you find out what happened out in Hawaii?
Okay, I was over at a lady's house that did laundry, picking up my white shirts. She washed them and pressed them. Of course, I don't know what paid for them then, not very much. And they were listening to the radio, and her daughter's boyfriend was in Pearl Harbor at that time, and they were waiting to hear from him to see whether, but I don't know whether he got killed or not.
And you're 18 years old at the time. What did that do to get that news?
It was disturbing that we were being attacked, and we were going to be at war. Yeah, I was getting my notice that I'd be drafted, and I'd already signed up and everything. And so two of our friends that we ran around with joined the Coast Guard. I saw them, and I said, well, they joined. Why didn't you tell us? So, you know, and so my brother and I, we both went down and joined.
And when you and your brother, is that younger brother?
Yeah, he's 13 months younger than me.
When you two signed up together, were you thinking they were going to let you stay together?
Oh, we didn't even think about it, but we did in boot camp. He was on top bunk, and I was on the bottom bunk. We went through boot camp. After boot camp, went down on the wharf to shipping and receiving. From there, I went to the Golden Gate Lifeboat Station. That's right down on the beach by Playland. It was rough duty, you know, we have to watch the girls go swimming. well, anyway, we'd take the lifeboat out through the waves in case the ship went aground, and I was there for 3 months, and then they shipped me out to the Farallon Islands.
I bet there's some people out there that don't know where the Farallon Islands are. I do. I've never been there. I'd like to go there. Tell us where they are and what it was you were doing out there.
Farallon Islands is 22 miles. It's west of Golden Gate. What we were doing, I had lighthouse duty and foghorn, and another fellow and I were in charge of that. If it got foggy, we started a big diesel up that had a big compressor, and that foghorn would rattle our beds at night. It just so loud. We would get the generators going and at night and turn on the light. Then we would stand a watch to take care of anything.
Well, and I'm intrigued by that duty because I've heard so many veterans tell me about, you know, in the immediate aftermath of Pearl Harbor, that there was this widespread concern on the West Coast that the Japanese are coming to the West Coast. If you're out on the Farallons, you're a lot closer to that potential enemy threat than anybody on the mainland. Was that something that you actually thought might happen, or not something you expected?
Well, yes, we thought about that a lot because where we stood our watch was down where the generators were going, and that the water was just a little ways down there. And all we had out there was an old rifle, and I don't remember any shells being around for it. And the officer in charge had a 45 and a 38, and a couple of times we got to practice firing those, but we didn't carry any. And when we'd stand watch at night in the generator room, we would open the little door that we walked in, and the back door closed. And if they come in the back door, open that shut the front door, and we knew to run. But nothing ever happened.
Good thing, because it sounds like if something did, you guys wouldn't have had much firepower at your disposal.
No, I thought about that, not having anything out there. And there was a report, and we had a radio shack out there too, and a lookout, which was up on one of the peaks there. We had heard of submarines in the area, but never seen any.
You know, as someone who grew up in Oklahoma, I imagine the scenery from the Farallons was a little different than it was out in Oklahoma or even in Orange Cove. Did you have time to enjoy the grandeur of the ocean and your surroundings there?
Yes, we did. My friend and I were in charge of that. Well, as soon as we get the motor cleaned up and everything, and the skies were clear, we got fish and lines, which the government supplied us. And we'd get some bait, we'd go over to the island, catch fish, and the cook would cook us up some fish. We would get a $23 a month subsistence for our food. And 1 month, we took enough of fish in, and we had $3 left over that they gave us. And when the tide would get low, he and I would take a sack and go down and fill it up with abalone. And right close to the landing where we would come into the island and get ashore, there was a hole, big hole in a rock there that the waves kept full. And we had a bar 10 foot long and a rake 10 foot long. And we'd go down and day or night get an abalone and two or three, whatever we wanted. And the cook said one, I remember one time, he says, it was 10 o'clock. You guys go get the abalone and we'll eat one. So we went, we prepared them, and he cooked them in butter, and we had crackers and abalone that night.
I got to tell you, I've interviewed hundreds of World War II veterans. I've never had one tell me about catching abalone and having it for dinner, so that's a first. And to be honest, I haven't had too many Coast Guard veterans on the program, and a lot of people think about the Army and the Navy and the Marines, and they think about the Air Force or what was then the Army Air Corps, and they forget about the Coast Guard. At the time, did you Coast Guard guys feel a little overlooked?
No, I didn't have any feeling. We were just called freshwater sailors, hooligan Navy and everything, but I didn't pay any attention to it. But I was out there. It was really good duty. We'd stay a month, 4 weeks, get a week off, we'd come home. And then you stay 6 weeks, you had 2 weeks off. But I did that one time, and it was boring. I says, nobody home to do anything with. But then after I was out there for 9 months, my brother, I knew he was going to go to sea. He went on a freighter, AK-96, and I forget the name of it, pulling a barge. So I went to the officer in charge, and I said, I want to transfer. I want to go to sea. So first thing that hit the dock was my papers that week, and I went into Bay and Powell and stayed 3 weeks or so, and they sent me down to the Coast Guard cutter Taney.
And the Taney is a ship that you can still go experience today. In fact, if you go to the Taney in Baltimore, you can see some of Mr. Kitchen's handiwork on that ship. We're going to get to that eventually. But what was your welcome to the Taney back then in the 1940s?
I'd like to tell you a little more about the Farallons, because it was really interesting. Yeah. That I have pictures there to show you that some of the fellows out there, their wives were living with them. They had houses out there because the lighthouse keepers were doing that duty before the war. And I don't know, must have been a half a dozen women out there on the island with us. It was just fun to be out there. And we'd take the 17-foot dory and go out and row out and go fishing. And it was good duty.
Kind of like your own little world.
Yes, it was. We were out there alone. And the buoy tender would bring our supplies out once a week, and that was on a Friday. And they'd bring it into the landing there, let a boom out and a platform down, and they'd put everything on it, and that's how we got ashore.
So you go from that isolated existence to being packed on a Coast Guard ship with a bunch of other young guys and restless guys. Was that an adjustment for you?
Well, yes, I guess it was adjustment. It wasn't hard to adjust to it, because my first trip down when we left San Francisco and got out, and we must have been down around Mexico someplace, but the water was so smooth, it's just like being on a cruise ship. And we get to Panama, and we all got to take liberty and go ashore and look around, and it was very interesting to go through the canal.
Yeah, I bet. I bet that's something that you had read about and certainly heard about, and to be there must have been fun.
It was, and to see how the operation, they had what they call donkeys, and there were tow cars on each side with cables, and they would pull all the ships through, and after you get through the canal, you go into a freshwater lake, and then you go into the Atlantic, and you go through the gates again.
And at that point, did you learn a little bit of the history of the ship that you were on, and where it had been the last couple of years before you got on it?
I've learned a lot about it, and I have pictures of the ship when it went to Baker Island. This was after the war started. They were going to survey it to put a runway on that island, that there was no life on it. But when they got there, there was a plane flying around. It was a plane looking for somebody. And so it flew over and dropped a couple of bombs at them, but they missed. So they went back to Honolulu. And later then they went back, but they had escorts, had fighter planes watching them. And they surveyed the island to put the metal runways down. And the fellow that helped me with the memorial was an engineer. After he got out of the service, he was good on the computer. And he had gone to school and learned a little bit about surveying, and the Navy went out to take care of it on the ship. And he did all this. He did the surveying, and the runway is still there, the old metal, but it's not used anymore.
Well, let's talk about the Taney and your job on that ship. Looking at your papers, I see you listed as carpenter's mate, third class. Was that your assignment when you got on the Taney? What was it like when you first got on that ship?
When I first went aboard, I was seaman second. And then I was seaman first. And after some time, then I wanted to go in the carpenter shop, because that's what I was doing before I went into service. And so then I finally made carpenter's mate, third class. And as you can see on the picture there, that there was a big plane that I borrowed from the ship when I left it. And we actually used that one time, because when we went up to Japan after the war,
I want to make sure our listeners understand here. When you say plane, you're not talking about airplane. You're a carpenter, so you're talking about a plane that a carpenter uses.
I will change that. A smoothing plane that you use to hang doors with. After I got it home, I was a carpenter, and I hung a lot of doors with that plane.
Let's not get the end of that story yet. Let's leave our listeners in suspense. But this is a tool that you actually used on the ship. So what kind of duties did you have working with wood on that ship?
One thing that I remember we used it on quite a bit when we went up to, after the war, went up to Japan, Wakayama, to evacuate prisoners. So the skipper wanted to make a mast for one of the lifeboats so he might be able to sail it. We don't understand why he did, but anyway, we went ashore. And we found a nice pole up there, and we brought it back aboard the ship. And believe it or not, we had a foot adze on there. Don't know what that was ever put on there for, but anyway, we used that to size it up pretty good. And we used this big smoothing plane, which is 23 inches long, to finish smoothing it up. And after the war was over and we headed back to Charleston, South Carolina, and I was going to get discharged, well, we stopped in San Francisco first. And I took two big sea bags off, and that plane was in it. And the gunnery officer said, "Kitch, I'm on duty tonight. You guys get your stuff off." After I brought the second bag out, he says, "Kitch, don't take it all off. I got to stay aboard the ship." Anyway, brought it home. We were having a reunion up in Oregon, and one of my shipmates says, "Kitch, if you'll put that back aboard the ship, I won't tell them you stole it." I says, "Look, I've used that. It fits my hand. I can feel it right now." And I thought about that after I got home for a couple, 3 years, and I thought, you know, maybe that'd be the thing to do. So I made a plaque out of it and took it and presented it to him. But it says, "Borrowed tool returned after 61 years.
Yeah, I'll post a picture of this on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, the newspaper article about 61 years later, that smoothing plane being returned. And I guess you can go see that plane if you visit the ship in Baltimore, huh?
You sure can. It's on the bulkhead, and my picture is there with it, smoking my pipe. And the carpenter's mate that was in charge, first class, I went down when I took to the ship. We drove back. Went down to New Mexico and had my picture taken with him, holding a plane, took it up and presented it to him. And it's on there now, and a lot of people go by and see it.
Well, I hope I have that chance someday. We have the chance to hear Jim's story today because a kamikaze that could have claimed his life was thwarted by an able and perhaps fortunate gun crew. We're going to hear about Jim's role in that fateful moment off of Okinawa when Hometown Heroes continues right after this.